Public Safety Committee will come to order. We have a quorum members. Representative Ward's going to, he's got the fancy glasses on, and he's going to move the minutes that he somehow read. moves the approval of the minutes of March 18, 2014. Is there any discussion? Do you have discussion about the minutes? Ward makes that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now we will take House File 2469. Representative Savick, you're first. Savick, you want to move your bill, and I understand it's going to Ways and Means from here.
Yes, I'd like to move my bill. Thank you.
So, Savick, go ahead and introduce your bill and your testifier.
First, I have an amendment that has to be.
Sorry about that.
It's a delete all amendment.
Okay, Representative Savick moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails.
Okay.
Now the bill is in the form that you like it, Representative Savick.
Thank you. This bill is actually being carried by three different representatives. It had to go through six committees, and so to expedite the process, they asked me to carry it into public safety and jobs. This bill, all it does is it improves or expedites the licensing process for former and current members of the military. It doesn't change the qualifications. You still have to have the qualifications for that particular job, but it just asks each people to expedite the licensing process. So. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, David Lean.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm David Lean with the Department of Military Affairs. I'm the Director of Support to Military Operations. Military Affairs does support this bill. You know, this bill does not really affect the Minnesota National Guard members that are serving in Minnesota, but it does allow the active duty component to transition into an easier transition into civilian life. And it fits really well with our Beyond the Yellow Ribbon community programs. With that said, Military Affairs does support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Mr. Waltz, we're trying to figure out if there's any cost to the bill here.
I don't think there's any cost because it simply asks people to expedite their licensing process.
Prior to the amendment, Representative Savick, there was a cost to the Private Detectives Board. I don't know if that's any. The amendment removes the cost.
The amendment removes. Okay.
Sorry. Okay. Is there any discussion, questions of the testifier or Representative Savick? Representative Ward.
Just a point of information for members is I sit in the Jobs Committee. I'm not sure if anybody else on this committee is in Jobs, but we heard this in Jobs, and it's important to understand that the standards of different licenses are not at all changed. Veterans still will need to meet the standards of the current board that their license that they're trying to get. And that's really important. This is just to allow our veterans an opportunity to get into the workforce quicker and then gain that license with the high standards that all the licenses have. And so I just wanted to point that out. That's really a good bill. I appreciate it and strongly support it.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Representative Savick, any closing comments?
Uh, just that this is an excellent bill, and I was very proud to be able to carry it, and I'd like to move that it goes to Ways and Means.
Representative Savick renews her motion that House File 2469 as... Well, let me ask, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in for or against the bill? Then Representative Savick renews her motion that House File 2469 be, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Savick. Ms. Hornstein? Representative Hornstein here? Okay, then we'll do House File 2148. Is Representative McNamara here? McNamer, I'm sorry. Representative McNamer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Pamar and committee members, I'm Representative Jay McNamer from District 12A, West Central Minnesota. My bill is here today to require all out-of-state registered predatory offenders who move to Minnesota to request them to register in Minnesota. I have a testifier here today, John Kringery, and he is Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And John?
Thank you.
Mr. Kingray, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I've got a statement that the Traverse County attorney asked me to hand out. He was hoping to be here this morning, but court obligations required he stay back in Traverse County. This is a situation that came to his attention last spring, when a Traverse County law enforcement officer arrested a man for failure to register in Minnesota. He was convicted twice in North Dakota for indecent exposure, a level 3 sex offender requiring lifetime registration in North Dakota. Had he committed that act in Minnesota, it would not have required registration, but it did require registration in North Dakota. After they filed, the Traverse County attorney filed a criminal complaint, he found out that he could not charge him for failure to register as a predatory offender in the state of Minnesota. Again, our registration law does not contain a full faith and credit provision requiring a person to register who has had to register in another state to register here in Minnesota. In this case, again, it was indecent exposure, a level 3 sex offense in North Dakota requiring lifetime registration. And with this amendment before you, with this legislation before you, it would require that the person register as a predatory offender if he had to register or she had to register in another state. And when someone transfers to Minnesota from another state, under the Interstate Compact, they have to meet with their probation officer, and so the probation officer would inform him or her of their requirement to register in Minnesota if this were to become law. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's the bill, and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions, Mr. Kingray or Representative McNamer? Apparently there is no cost to the bill. And so and you don't need to hear this, Representative Hillstrom. So then is there anyone in the audience wish to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Representative McNamer, you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
I appreciate you allowing us to be here.
Okay, then the chair will move. I guess I never moved your bill. The chair will move that House File 2148 be referred to the General Register. Any discussion on Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. Do we have any idea how many people this may impact? And if so, then was a fiscal note requested even?
Mr. Kingrey, Mr. Waltz, there was a fiscal note. Mr. Waltz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, I had a conversation with Kathleen Lonergan at the Department of Corrections. She was unsure as to whether or not this would require any duties by the Department of Corrections to supervise these folks. She requested I put in a fiscal note request, which was put in last week, but there is no data in the system yet from the Department of Corrections as to a cost.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then a question would be, do we have any idea how many people this would affect?
Mr. Kingrey.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I asked that question of the county attorney just to get his thoughts because I thought the fiscal note question would come up. He said because we have reciprocity on most of our sex offender laws that he didn't believe that there would be that this would only fall to a small number of offenders and that there would not be a fiscal note. That was his belief. But I did ask him that question. Again, because of reciprocity with other states, most of these folks do have to register, and we're trying to capture this very, very small number of people, in which is simply a loophole, we believe, in our statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No cost? Okay. No cost. No cost to the Department of Corrections. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that was my question as well.
Okay, very good. So the chair will renew his motion that House File 2148 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative McNamer and Mr. Kingrey. Next, we have Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the Public Safety Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I know since this is your last term, I want to see you as many times as possible.
Representative Hornstein, I will move House File. The chair will move House File 3134. And where is it going? To Transportation Finance. Representative Hornstein, do you want to introduce your bill? Tell us what it does.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members. I called Representative Earhart, Madam, yesterday too. I don't know. It's the end of session, or end of deadline week. So, anyway, Mr. Chair, want to thank you for hearing House File 3134. The reason that we're in Public Safety Committee is that this is one of three bills that have been introduced that deal with the growing problem of transport of oil through the state of Minnesota. Because of the oil rush in North Dakota, the Bakken field, we're seeing a significant increase in train traffic and new pipeline construction to accommodate that oil flowing out of the North Dakota and Alberta oil fields to destinations and refineries to the east and south. And so that makes Minnesota really at the epicenter of this oil transportation issue. We have had over the last couple of months and even within the last year some significant developments related to this issue. First of all, in Quebec last year, an oil train similar to the trains that are proliferating through Minnesota exploded in a population center. It was a town in Quebec. 47 fatalities occurred as a result of that exploding oil train. We've had it just to the west of Minnesota, 20 miles to the west of Fargo, in a town called Castleton, North Dakota. A train exploded on December 30th into a huge fireball just a few thousand feet from the edge of town. Had that train moved into the town of Castleton, again, there would have been numerous fatalities. So because of those two incidents and a few others around the country, people have started to examine, are we prepared in terms of our emergency response for these kinds of fires and spills? And the reason this has become such an important issue in Minnesota, as I said, we are at the crossroads of so many transportation routes for this oil. The oil coming out of North Dakota has some specific characteristics that make it particularly problematic. First, it's a light sweet crude that is mixed with various chemicals. It's particularly volatile. And so the National Transportation Safety Board was so concerned about oil train safety and this type of oil, that they issued a directive in January that said you shouldn't be transporting the stuff through densely populated areas. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board gives advice. It's not the force of law. But I think we have to take that very seriously. Shortly thereafter, another federal agency said the particular oil coming out of North Dakota, we need to have some additional regulation of its contents and its mixtures. Shortly after that, Warren Buffett, who's Berkshire Hathaway company, a holding company, has a large stake in Burlington Northern Santa Fe, said the cars themselves are not adequate enough that I will personally buy thousands of new up-to-date oil tanker cars to transport this oil. And we've had a few other examples of different federal agencies addressing this problem. So what we have done is introduce three separate bills to address this issue. One deals with the transportation issue specifically. One deals with cleanup issues and the Pollution Control Agency. The one before you deals with the public safety response. And so, Mr. Chairman, I did have a brief oral amendment that I would like to offer in order to get the bill in shape. And then I have just a couple of testifiers as well, or maybe three testifiers. So.
Very good. What is your oral amendment?
On page 4, line 26, there was a drafting error. And the number 5 million should be changed to 2.5 million. Actually, I want to go through the bill quickly as well. Would you prefer that before the testimony?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to do the amendment.
So,
so the chair will move on line 4.26, delete 5 million and insert $2,500,000.
Correct.
Correct?
Correct.
Are there any other amendments?
That's it.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Okay. Quickly, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to just go through the sections of the bill. The first section relates to...
Representative Hornstein, as you do that, maybe you can... I've tried to note the areas of the bill that are specifically related to this committee.
Correct.
Maybe you could highlight those just in case we have overlooked those.
Okay. Thank you. The first section is very directly related to the committee because it lays out some duties of the Commissioner of Public Safety that are new duties related to railroad and pipeline spill safety. I want to emphasize this also relates to pipelines. We've had some issues with pipeline spills, particularly in another state in Michigan, that was very, very problematic. So while a lot of the public attention has been paid to railroads, we also have pipelines included in the bill. So the first one is we're assisting local emergency managers and fire officials to get a better sense of these of what's the hazards that are endemic to this type of material. Secondly, we're going to assist the pipeline companies to develop protocols and railroads and pipeline companies to develop the protocols for the first responders. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but the basic gist of this, Mr. Chairman and members, is that because this material is so new and so dangerous, we need to have a process within the Department of Public Safety in relationship to the companies and the first responders to identify specific needs and the costs of items like foam and the training needs that these first responders have. In my committee, the legislative process around this, in my Transportation Finance Committee, we had 2 days of hearings. And there were a couple of quotes from commissioners and first responders that I think are relevant to this section and future sections that we're going to talk about. The first is we had someone from the Professional Firefighters Association that felt that it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when we might have one of these disasters here. And I think that really was a powerful statement to me. We had the Commissioner of Public Safety testify on the record in my committee that she feels that this is one of the things that keeps first responders up at night. And then finally, we had someone from MnDOT that said this is a whole new ball game and the stakes are pretty high. So that's what we're doing in the first section of the bill. In the The new language in on page 3 talks about a grant program that we would like to initiate through the Department of Public Safety. And this is going out to some of these first responder organizations, fire departments in particular, through the Fire Safety Fund. And so this is the criteria for this grant program. Again, we want to make sure that we're getting the proper training and equipment to our first responders to address this new and emerging need. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, we lay out on page 4 some definitions of these materials. We want to have first responders notified when these materials are coming through their communities. And then the last part of page 4 discusses the funding for this. Half and half. We believe that half of this should come from the public sector and half of it should come from the private entities that are involved in transporting this. And I want to take this opportunity to thank Representative Neuberger. He came to another committee and laid out actually some good rationale for this bill as a first responder himself. And one of the things that Representative Neuberger pointed out is that we can't allow, this is not something that just the public sector and just the private sector should be responsible for. That I think both need resources, both need direction in terms of how to properly respond to these incidents. So we have a shared responsibility where we assess the companies. This is state law that we have and already on the books in terms of assessments to railroads for track inspectors. We're using that section of law to fund this, and we are going to take some general fund money for this grant program. So it's a total of $5 million. And the final section of the bill is on page 5, which is very, very important. We still have incomplete data in terms of what our needs are in terms of funding and the needs of first responders. And so while we're getting some money out the door, we're going to also assess and evaluate the grant program in Section 4. So that's the bill, Mr. Chairman, and happy to take your questions.
President Hornstein, we have questions, but I support the bill, but I'm confused about the funding. So there's $2.5 million that will be assessed to the railroads.
And pipeline companies.
And then the other $2.5 million is public money coming from the general fund, but it seems like, if I read the bill correctly, it looks like it's coming from the fire safety account.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is going to the fire safety account and then to the grant program. So it's an additional allocation to the fire safety fund.
Okay, so you're not, it's not money that's,
it's not existing money, it's new money. But it will be directed to the fire safety fund.
And where is the money coming from?
Well, right now, as you know, in the Ways and Means Committee, we had general fund appropriations to each division, and I'm hoping that we can include this in a transportation finance allocation from the general fund of one-time monies.
I see. Okay. All right. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Politics certainly makes strange bedfellows. I do support this bill. There are some kinks that I think need to be addressed when it comes to how we're going to pay for it. I understand that that's always food for good political fights. But I will say this. The community, the district that I represent, there is a rail line that basically runs the spine of central Minnesota. It basically parallels Highway 10. Every 28 minutes, there's a train that goes by. These are unit trains. They're 110 cars. When these flammable fluids, these combustible liquids are being transported, each car contains 30,000 gallons of sometimes it's natural gas, sometimes it's this oil. My house is 3/4 mile from the tracks. These things blow me out of bed every night. It's just the cost of living there. However, Suffice to say, if one of these, it just takes one of these trains at the at the right place at the wrong time, and we are looking at a catastrophe. I have had discussions with fire officials, some of the chiefs as well, and this is, Representative Hornstein is correct that this is an issue that we can do something about. I do want to reiterate that this does not prevent accidents. This is not going to per se prevent it, but what this does is it gives us a better tool on how to deal with and address should this situation occur. Right now, we're quickly moving. In 5.5 years, we're going to start an accelerated process. Right, they're scrambling to try to find a different way to provide baseload electricity. I offered a bill earlier this week that would try to address that situation. Unfortunately, it didn't go anywhere. Right now, we have coal trains that come in about twice a day, two big unit coal trains that come in through our districts. If a coal train derails, you get out a broom and you sweep it up. We, since we're moving away from coal and there's our next baseload option, right now they're not going to build any new nuclear plants that we know of. Natural gas plants are the next option, and getting a pipeline in anywhere is like pulling teeth with the feds. So the only option that the realistic option that we have to deal with right now is putting putting fuel into these cars and transporting them 110 at a time at 30,000 gallons apiece. So this is something that we do need to address. The fiscal part of me, the fiscal conservative in me, I'm repressing that part of myself because the cost overall isn't that it's worth it. When we have these type of trains, we have 110 of these things coming through and at 30,000 gallons apiece. We do need to address this, and I want to thank Representative Hornstein for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, when I look at the, I was just curious about on the grant program, and is there, I think this is fantastic as far as I'm concerned. I thank you for bringing this forward. It's a big issue in my district as well, too. What I'm concerned about is, or more curious about, is administration of that particular portion of the grant. If that's adding to the fire safety account, is there going to be provisions, or do you foresee that if Representative Simonson and I have, you know, and Representative Neuberger have these through our communities every 20 minutes, versus some of the counties in Minnesota don't have rail lines through them at all, this money to be specified for this? Because that could be a bit concerning to make sure that it's going to the right places. Maybe more commentary and question. So if you have some ideas on that, I'd appreciate hearing that.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schoen. That is certainly the intent, and we have the Fire Safety Advisory Group empowered to kind of go through this. But we're going to have a some criteria that make sure that the money's going to the right place. For example, in my other bill, which is in the Transportation Committee, we have money for grade crossings. So it's not just any grade crossing. It would be a grade crossing, for example, in Representative Neuberger's district that has oil and other hazardous trains going through it where you don't have, gates and the proper safety infrastructure there. So that would be the intent, certainly.
Representative Savick.
Yes, I have some questions about the fire safety account. Right now it is used to train firefighters. And I'm just wondering, according to the way that this is written, it looks like all of it would be transferred to this. And I'm wondering if we have anything in the bill that would protect the fire safety account so that that portion of it that needs to go to training new firefighters or training them is still there.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Savick, if it's not in the bill, I'll make sure that we add language that specifies that this particular money goes to this particular purpose, the new money.
Okay.
This is not meant to drain the fire safety count of its other resources that are used for other purposes beyond this that are statewide. We felt that this was the proper place for it. There may be some other mechanisms that the Department of Public Safety has, but in my consultations with people, we felt this was the proper place for it. And I just wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, that agencies, Department of Public Safety was consulted in this. Some of the language is there. Some of it is mine. Some of it is from first responders that we consulted with. So this isn't an agency bill. It's not a firefighter's bill, per se. I think we took a lot of different ideas and included those in the bill. So the fire safety account piece really came from the first responder community.
Okay. My concern, to follow up on Representative Savick's, is exactly the opposite. I'm worried that the fire safety account is going to balloon into an already problematic account that this legislature deals with year in and year out. And how are we to know who's going to be evaluating, I guess, this committee in the future? Somebody will. A lot of people just signed up to ask questions of you. My concern is that that account is going to grow and grow and grow, and I don't know how to deal with that. And anyone who's been around here, Representative Cornish, others, you know that this is an ongoing problem, and now we're going to be adding $2.5 million a year annually to this account.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hornstein.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I completely agree, and I've had some conversations with the rail industry, and we're going to add some language. I just didn't have a chance to amend the bill in time today, but we want to make this a three-year program initially. The general fund is a one-time allocation.
Yes.
And it'd be nice if we had that in the tails figure, but I can't guarantee that. I don't know whether this private sector contribution is going to survive the legislative process. I hope it does. I think it's appropriate. But this is going to be a time-limited and funding-limited project where we get some money out to first responders initially. If we find out that there are additional needs, we'll revisit it. But I think this is the proper figure based on the needs that have been identified now in terms of training, in terms of equipment. So I would agree with you, Mr. Chairman, that we don't want this to take over the fire safety fund, usurp it, and to not have accountability. So it is going to be walled off. It's going to be time limited.
Representative Hornstein, you misunderstood my question and my concern. I don't have the same concern that Representative Savick does about that the fire safety account as defined will be depleted. That's a good question to bring up. I'm worried about that the fire safety account is going to balloon into an account that keeps growing and growing and growing. And that's my concern. Representative Simons.
Well, Mr. Chairman, can I just say, I will say on the record and commit to you and members of the committee that this is a time-limited and funding-limited program that will sunset. I'm saying 3 years. We can talk more about that.
Well, I think between now and when the bill, where is it going next, goes to your committee, maybe we can think of some more language to tighten
up. I'd like to work with you.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming we're going to have testimony on this bill.
Yes, that's a good idea.
And it may make sense for me to hold my question until after that.
All right. Representative Kelly, Johnson, and Cornish, can you wait, or do you want to ask your question of the author first?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question kind of on the dollar amount as well.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I'm just curious because, I mean, I understand you're saying this is a short-term deal, but this is, in all practical purposes, another tax. I have yet to see many taxes taken off once they've been put on. But I'm curious more, the $2.5 million, where did that dollar come from? Where's the $5 million come from?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, this is conversations with first responders about needs that they have. And I've learned a lot. I have to say I haven't looked at the finances of emergency response and fire protection as closely as I might have, perhaps I should have, over the time I've been in the legislature. But, you know, there's I learned about overtime. I learned about training. I learned about equipment. And this seemed to be what the immediate needs might be for both larger fire departments and emergency responders as well as volunteers, that this is not an inexpensive proposition, equipment and training. And we are going to have in Section 4 a much more detailed study that will itemize the costs. We couldn't do that in the last few weeks. And I failed to mention this, Mr. Chairman, but I know the governor had met in February with his commissioners to try to figure out some options. I wasn't in on those meetings, but we wanted to put something together for the legislative session that was modest, that addressed this issue, that moved us forward without breaking the bank, but also got some real money out to communities and to first responders, because this is not an inexpensive proposition.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
I think, you know, I've been around now for 5 years on this committee as well, and I think this fire safety account has become an issue time and time again. The one thing that we keep reacting to is terrible situations that come up, and I understand the desire to do that. But as we saw a parade of communities come through here already with requests for bonding for regional safety centers, for more training, for things to stay up. We're always talking about we got to stay up on current events and current issues. And we are funding that. And we're funding that in a great amount. So I'm really kind of struggling as why are we funding it on one side with all these new training centers and keeping all our firefighters and volunteers up to date on the absolute issues that come up of the day. And then now, because we have another incident come up, we're expecting both private and public investment into an account, which for what I can see, we took a shot in the dark at an amount that said, well, this sounds like a good number, let's put it in, and we'll put in the fire safety account. I understand the desire to want to do that, but I think we're most of the way there with the way we funded already. Thank you.
Let's take your testifiers before we open it up to further questions. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record when you testify.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Prilliman. I'm the Fire Chief and Emergency Management Director for the City of Brooklyn Park. It's a pleasure to be back here today and share with you some comments with regard to the bill before you. I'm here representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. Overall, we are in support of the bill that's been presented. I'd like to take just a few moments and comment to some of the questions that have been raised, tell you about the features of the bill that are important to us, and share with you just a couple of hiccups inside the bill that are still being addressed. Before I do so, I'd like to remind the committee that oil isn't the only hazardous material that are running down our rails. We have a tremendous amount of hazardous material, as the member pointed out, including anhydrous ammonia and hundreds of others that pose serious threats to our communities. Minnesota is protected by 791 fire departments. Most of those are volunteer or paid on-call fire departments, which these types of risks create significant challenges for those. I believe last week in the Transportation Committee, Homeland Security reported 134 of those fire departments have one of these rail lines running through their community. And I would testify that virtually none of them are prepared today to handle the type of an event that we saw in Castleton on December the 30th. With all due respect, I'd like to remind this committee, as I have had an opportunity in the past to do, Minnesota ranks 47th in fire department funding. We are woefully behind our partners across the United States in terms of preparing our fire department first responders for an ever-changing mission. I started in this business in 1978, and they taught me how to be a firefighter. Today, we are an all-hazards emergency response organization. In order to be effective, in order to protect our community, it's fires, it's hazardous materials, it's weapons of mass destruction, it's homeland security issues, and literally takes hundreds and hundreds of hours to have a firefighter who is even remotely capable of responding to the various events. And no community in this state or any community across the country is completely immune from the types of disasters that we see. In addition, and certainly outside the scope of this bill or this committee, our ability to continue to recruit and retain is in a serious state of disrepair. And so we are having a very difficult time engaging firefighters in the ongoing need to train, the ongoing need to remain current. They are just no longer willing to commit the time necessary to be adequately prepared for every emergency that might hit their community. This bill, as was pointed out, is primarily a bill that addresses preparation and response. There is no mitigation, and we have heard testimony here and in other committees with regard to a number of issues that could be addressed, but it's important to focus on that this bill is purely focused on equipping our firefighters to respond to a disaster. It does nothing to change the safety of those trains coming through our state. The equipment, the training is an important component of this bill. We have many communities that even if 100% of their firefighters were trained to a hazardous material technician level, which is hundreds of hours of training, they still might only have a dozen firefighters and would not be able to respond. With just one hazardous material response team and 11 chemical assessment teams throughout the state, we're woefully short in terms of being able to respond in a timely manner to the type of incident that we saw in Castleton. One concern that we do have, although the funding will certainly help, a grant program versus a reimbursement program does create certain challenges for some of our smaller communities in that their fire chiefs are also part-time or paid on call or volunteer. Their experience and their ability to write grant proposals is limited. We have a system in the state that works well with reimbursement. It may be a method that we'd like to continue to have some discussion regarding reimbursement versus grants. And secondly, we believe strongly that the reporting in the bill is important. The fact that as these hazardous materials are rolling through our state and through our communities, we have very little reporting today. It is not until we have a disaster and if the engineer has survived that disaster, it is their first responsibility to present the manifest to the first responders. That's a little behind the curve in our estimation. We'd like to see better reporting. The language that's before you today, from a fire perspective, we recognize is a little onerous on the railroad industry, and we believe that there's a way to make that easier for them to comply and for us to have access to what's rolling through our community. Lastly, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Parsons, I would like to address the concern of the chair with regard to the growing fire safety account and tie it back to the fact that our mission has also grown significantly and continues to grow. I somewhat tongue-in-cheek shared with the Transportation Committee that if a rocket lands in City Hall and begins to ooze green fluid out onto the lawn, it's the fire department you're going to call. And the only way that we're going to be able to mitigate and respond to that is with training, with the right equipment. The continuous need to keep up with active shooters in schools, improvised explosive devices, weapons of mass destruction, nerve agents that could be detonated within our community requires an ongoing commitment of resources. That fire safety account has done an amazing job, but still leaves us far behind other states in the nation. At this time, I'll turn it over to Mr. Parsons. Mr. Chair.
I appreciate your comments. And just for the committee, the edification of the committee, just so you know that if we do this, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, that in the next biennium, there'll be $8.1 million in the fire safety account. Mr. Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you there. I have no problem with the premise of the bill, but your and I history with a fire safety account, the whole thing that caused all the consternation was the large balance, and so I would encourage the chair to work with the author to find some other system of distribution or at least a quick pass-through or something, because there's no telling what's going to happen to that fund if we get into that same trouble again with millions of dollars. So,
Thank you. Next is Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and thank you for taking up this issue today and allowing me to be here. I won't get too deep into the problem. I think that Chief Perlman and Representative Hornstein and certain members of this committee have already done a pretty good job of outlining the problem. I would like to state that this bill is being dubbed the spill bill, and I think that's a misnomer. It's more like the oil train explosion response bill, which I think adds to the much more to the need for this type of legislation. There's eight times as much Bakken crew riding the rails in 2013 as there was in 2011, and these are trains up to 2 miles long, traveling through our cities and towns up to 60 miles per hour. Minnesota's Grand Central Station for crude oil heading south and east across the country. There are high profile events in the area and also in Quebec, but we can expect these types of events to increase as the oil region in the Bakken has yet to be fully tapped. So we can expect more of these types of incidents, and there's even incidents that aren't even as high profile, but are definitely happening in and around the state. We've known this. We've known that there's been dangerous stuff rolling down the rails for years. Us in the public safety sector. It's just these high profile events have now brought it to public light, and actually, in my estimation, it's about time. As Chief Perlman explained that the risk profile has definitely increased, and you know, these oil train derailments and explosions are capable of leveling an entire neighborhood or town, causing massive loss of life and property. And mitigating such a disaster or responding to such a disaster right now is way beyond the current capabilities of our fire departments. We need specially trained and equipped response teams. We need strategically placed response teams throughout the state. We need ongoing funding for training and equipment upkeep. And taxpayers should not have to shoulder this burden alone. This is an industry issue, and everybody needs to help pay the freight for this type of response. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions so far? Then the next is Mr. Larkin? No? Mr. Freed, sorry.
Joel McCall, City of Savage, Fire Chief and Emergency Management Director.
What was the name again?
Joel McCall, J-O-E-L-M-C-C-O-L-L. And you've heard most of the testimony from Chief Perlman and President Parsons. I'm here in support of this bill. In Savage, I come from a community of approximately 28,000 people. Our rail lines run right through the heart of our community. Had one of those two previous tragedies occurred in my community, this would have been catastrophic to our community. We have a saying in Savage, the further you are away from your previous event, the closer you are to your next one. With the turnover I have in my paid on-call fire department, it's critical to continue to support the funding for the fire service and primarily this bill. I'm constantly training and educating new firefighters. With that said, I want to make it quick. I know you have a busy schedule today, so I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of the testifiers? Thank you all. Anybody else that wishes to speak in opposition or in favor of the bill? Gentlemen, welcome to the committees. Who wants to start?
I will.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Judson Freed. I'm Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for Ramsey County, Minnesota. And I am the chair of the Government Affairs Committee for the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, or AMEM. Our membership is represents more than 400 professional emergency managers across the state through all 87 counties, all of the cities of the first class, and most of the cities and towns throughout the state. On behalf of our association, I'm here today to express our appreciation to Representative Hornstein and to the committee for hearing this legislation and to voice our qualified support for House File 3134. While an incident of this type that the bill addresses would initially be handled by the fire department, it's no emergency of this kind of magnitude is ever dependent on only one emergency response discipline. In coordinating the needs of the fire service, law enforcement, public works, public health, the community members affected, and the elected officials of those communities that are affected by these disasters is the legally mandated role of my colleagues and myself. Our concerns also share some of yours with issues of how the funding is spelled out and how the grants language is spelled out, but primarily our concern is only in the language of this bill. And we feel that our concerns would be very easily addressed going forward. So we look forward to working towards our shared goal of enhancing the public safety in Minnesota by working with you and the others of the legislature to further develop the language of this bill. In order to further amplify our association and the emergency management professional viewpoint, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Rick Larkin, Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul and a member of our committee at AMIC.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Freed. Mr. Larkin.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to appear today in support of House File 3134. As Director Freed said, my name is Rick Larkin. I'm the Director of Emergency Management for your host city here, the City of St. Paul. I am a certified emergency manager, and I've been in the profession for over 16 years. Prior to becoming an emergency management professional, it is what I do full-time here in the city of the first class. Many of my colleagues are not full-time, as Chief Brilliman shares multiple hats and Chief McCall shares multiple hats, but we do have some of us that do this for a full-time career. I was both a career and a volunteer firefighter in two area fire departments. I'm not representing the St. Paul Fire Department, Chief Butler has the ability to do that, but I would point out to the committee, as Chief Brilliman and President Parsons said, we do have 11 chemical assessment teams throughout the state and one emergency response team, full emergency response team for hazardous materials. That response team is the St. Paul Fire Department. So we have extensive experience and, frankly, interest in this subject. As an emergency manager, it's my job to make sure that community-wide plans, training, exercise, and prevention efforts by multiple departments and disciplines are coordinated to the highest level possible. I support 3134 and its companion legislation. I appreciate the legislature taking the subject of public safety so seriously, certainly in response to Representative Kelly's concerns about when is enough enough. And I think the comment is really, we don't necessarily understand the cards that are dealt with us. Our complex society determines whether or not we use chemicals, we use oil, we use plastics materials, and those things have to be shipped. So we try and balance the risk profile with the prevention and response capabilities. And that's what we're really talking about doing here with this particular bill, is developing response capabilities. It's a much deeper, much more complex situation than that, but we are talking about building capabilities. Just a bit, if I can, Mr. Chair, about the community profile of St. Paul that illustrates the point. The City of St. Paul values the strong history of the railroads and the development and economic growth of the city, as well as recognizes the value to our state and our region of the railroad. We have a significant rail presence. Our community has three Class 1 railroads or heavy freight railroads in our city, Burlington Northern, CP Rail, and UP. Just this morning, before I came to this committee, I spoke to the hazardous materials coordinator from one of those Class 1 railroads, and I have 50 to 100 cars in my rail yard with hazardous materials. Now, that's general classification, placarded hazardous materials. Representative Schoen, same area, that line in that area. We have one intermodal facility, which integrates and supports commerce through over-the-road trucking and rail. We have the Midway Transfer Yard, which supports Burlington Northern's movement of freight through their system. And then the big one is CP Rail's major terminal at Pig's Eye. This particular yard is as wide as 47 sets of tracks, so 47 rails wide, and up to 6 to 7 miles long. It serves both an inbound and outbound terminal for breaking up and putting together trains. So all of that oil that we've been talking about, as well as other chemicals I might reinforce, comes through that yard, gets broken up, reconfigured into another train on its way to its final destination. So Class 1 tracks through St. Paul are adjacent to critical infrastructure, key resources, city, state, federal level critical infrastructure. And then lastly, as you're well aware, the Amtrak passenger rail and the Union Depot terminal is now part of a multimodal transportation system. So we have a significant network here in the city of St. Paul. As the committee deliberates this bill, we'd like to remind you that preparedness is a community-wide goal. In order to achieve strategic level preparedness, what I call it, or that comprehensive preparedness, we need to have the whole community needs and the range of hazardous materials. Certainly oil is top of mind and presents the biggest issue at this time. As you consider the bill, we would support passing it out of committee today, Mr. Chair, and cleaning up some language and perhaps expand the scope, as Representative Hornstein discussed and other testifiers have mentioned, to include the emergency management as a whole. Current statute already requires a comprehensive emergency management plan in the community, so we have the mechanisms in place to just expand that. And in conclusion, Mr. Chair and members, I thank you and I appreciate your support today of passing 3134 out of committee, and we will be happy to work with the authors and the funding mechanism.
Thank you for your testimony. We're running a little short on time here. We have four members who have questions or comments, and we have two more testifiers, and we have a bill from Representative Slocum that we want to hear this morning still. Sir, please, who wanted to go next?
Mr. Chairman, Philip Qualley with the United Transportation Union, representing 1,400 conductors, switch foremen, yard masters, remote control locomotive engineers in Minnesota, and following up on the testifiers' comments, yes, we are the men and women operating in those yards. We do support this legislation. You know, at the outset, I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman, and it is a privilege to sit before your committee today. I want to state clearly that oil and other hazmat materials have been moving safely on the railroad for decades. Oil is being moved safely by our train crews at this moment and will be moving years from now by rail. However, incidents of derailment do occur, and we must be prepared. UTU supports the intent of this legislation to protect public safety. We welcome our state's interest in this safety area that has been in our charge, has been one of our grave concerns for decades. I just want to mention very briefly from a previous testifier, if a train crew should survive a hazmat train derailment was the reference. And I just very quickly, it is the conductor and the engineer that have the most updated train list, detailed train list hazmat information with that train. Oftentimes, computer systems for the data centers of the railroads may not have updated a train's consist. So, you know, we just want to be clear on this, also, I would like to direct respectfully the committee's attention to subdivision section 3, subdivision 2, hazmat trip notification. We just simply want to point out respectfully to the committee that any hazmat information that is being released from the private railroad companies, the common carriers in charge of that cargo, must be kept in the highest level of data security, as well as the leadership protocols of specific public responders. So in closing, I just want to thank you very much, and I want to thank Chairman Hornstein for bringing this legislation forward. Whatever our opinions or concerns regarding the shipments of oil and hazmat, We are going to continue by moving it by rail. I think we need to guard against needless alarmism. However, I do think that we need and we respectfully submit to the state that you should act with urgency. Thank you. We support this bill.
Mr. Qualley, I wasn't sure what your issue was in Subdivision 3 and if that's something that we need to look at or you can work with Representative Hornstein on.
We will certainly work with all parties. We hope to work in a collaborative manner, but we simply, with trip notification, subdivision 2, oil and other hazardous materials transport, we just think that you have to really guard against any of that type of data or information being getting into the wrong hands.
Does this mean that the bill has to go to civil law also?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am not an attorney nor a legislator. We are simply just citing the importance of keeping this data.
Flesh is here, so we won't tell him. Okay, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Paymar and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Dave Brown. I'm the Minnesota State Legislative Board Chairman for the Minnesota Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. I'm also the Region 3 National Legislative Chairman for the National Legislative Board of Association. We're also a division of the Teamsters and the rail divisions, and I'm pleased to be before you today. The BLET is the exclusive representative of the locomotive engineers throughout the country. I sit in support of this bill. I believe on my part, training has always been an issue. I have been involved with hazardous material training on the awareness level since 1992 through grants from the Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Transportation, Department of Energy. Now we have another champion along with us is the Firefighters Association. We have been awarded grants to continue the training for our members in the field. I believe that this bill will needs to have that training that is sorely needed by all parties. The situational training, not only the classroom training, but situational exercises. The train crews along with the first responders, because train crews are first responders by the very nature of our job. We're going to come upon or be involved in the incident firsthand. And we need that information to pass along to the first responders for their safety and the safety of the public. With that said, the responders need the equipment necessary to provide not only the safety for us as, after we've been involved in an incident, but the safety of the public and the environment. These DOT 111A cars that they're transporting this in have been known for years that they are inadequate to haul this commodity. We have suggested a few simple fixes to this, including getting removing the DOT 111 cars from the rails. But getting off a hand here, that I would like to I'll have more discussions with Representative Hornstein on improving the bill and some of the issues that we have are simple fixes that we feel that would encourage and support the safety for the public, the environment, and our members and the first responders for the hauling of the oil. I appreciate for you to allow me to come before you and give this short testimony in support of Representative Hornstein's bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Brown. We have questions. Are they for the author or the testifiers? Representative Simonson was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I actually have a number of questions, but I think what I'm going to do in the interest of time is say that, first of all, thank you, Representative Hornstein, for bringing this forward. I think this is a good bill, but I think in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, what I want to do is work with Representative Hornstein between now and his next stop to address my questions. My second point.
Representative Simons, are they related to the jurisdiction of this committee? I'd rather you do it now. I'd rather stay a little bit longer rather than having this bill come back here again.
All right. So, well, let's get into it then. Is there anybody here from DPS that manages the state hazardous materials teams? Excellent.
Come on up, sir. Members, if you wouldn't mind staying a little, I understand Representative Slocum's bill is non-controversial. It's non-controversial, so we can get through. People always say that. Oh, sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kevin Reed. I'm the branch director for operations for Minnesota Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and under my branch is the hazardous materials teams.
Good, thank you. So as you know, and I think as many people know, the reason why the hazardous materials teams were originally created was to deal with hazardous materials incidents across the state. And we have seen, Mr. Chair and committee members, a reduction in response levels, if you will, across the state. I know Duluth Fire, for example, used to be an ERT, emergency response team, and now we've been downgraded to a chemical assistance team. Far as I know, right now, St. Paul has the only emergency response team across the state of Minnesota. I'm fully aware that in the event that we have an incident that happens anywhere in the northern half of the state, we're going to be asked to go there and we're going to be asked to respond to that incident. What I'm missing in this bill and what I don't see and what I don't understand is where's the link with the existing hazardous materials response teams? And if we're going to talk about spending $5 million or whatever the amount happens to be, how much money are we going to put into those existing teams to bring them back up to maybe where they used to be or to the point where they can deal with what they're going to be asked to deal with? Because no matter where the incident is, whether it's Duluth or St. Paul or Grand Rapids, you know, the local fire department, the local law enforcement's going to go there, and they're going to make an assessment, and they're going to call the state. Okay, and the state duty officer is going to dispatch the nearest chemical assessment team and emergency response team. So where is the link between what's in this bill and the existing structure there?
Mr. Reed.
The link is still need to be worked on a little bit on that. Currently in that state, we would send multiple teams, and that's sort of where we've come to based on threat. But that is something we would have to work with the author on, and on that particular. I don't have an exact answer for you on where that link is right now.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
And thank you for that answer. And I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but I'm putting you on the spot here because this is an existing emergency response structure that we have in the state. And I'm not opposed to spending the money. I think it's a worthy cause and it's a worthwhile cause, but what we really probably need to do is make sure that part of this includes reinforcing our existing response network, if you will, and making sure that the teams that we currently have in place are A, fully funded, and B, you know, adequate enough to respond to these types of emergencies that we're talking about. I think there's a definite need for an awareness level education, if you will, statewide. But I also know for a fact that in the event that something happens anywhere in Minnesota, that you're going to get one of the first phone calls and you're going to turn around and dispatch those existing teams. So I think that needs to be a part of this structure. And my final question, Mr. Chair, for him is how many emergency response teams did we used to have? Currently we have one. How many did we used to have?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chairman, before my time, there was a maximum of five.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have some concerns with this bill. First of all, I want to thank the railroads. As a former fire department, the railroads, the pipeline companies, all those companies, when we needed to just ask them for some training and some knowledge about what's going on, they were more than welcome to come to our fire department. They helped us with our training. They were good at it. They knew what was going on. And they provided the information that, as a fire department, especially a volunteer fire department with limited funds, knowledge that we needed for the situations that could arise. That goes to Section 1, Section 3A. All that information is already being done. It's being done. All the pipeline companies, railroad yards, gas companies, contact our volunteer fire department to provide that information. There again, the concept of the bill is good, but a lot of this stuff is already being done. And another section that I have a lot of concern with, which I believe it needs to go to civil law, is the trip notification. As many of you know, I was a police officer and I work nights. If you want to get the bejeebers scared out of you, read the placards on the train cars going by. I worked in a small town where we had time to do that.
Oil and gas, that's nothing compared to the stuff that's running on these trains. That's a minor issue compared to some of these chemicals going through. My district is north of here, and the requirements are for some of these chemicals to go through the least populated areas. That's the northern route up towards Duluth into Representative Simonson's area, but right through the heart of my district. One night, I got to see one of the rarest trains going through. Two brand new locomotives, but before the two locomotives came through, was two black SUVs full of antennas. Train came through, brand new white cars, not a single marking on them. And while that train was going through, two more black SUVs came through. Behind the train was a couple more black SUVs. That's the nuclear train. They don't notify when it's coming through. It just goes through when they have to move the stuff. Never know when they're going to move it, and it's hidden in top. It's a top secret train. That information cannot be released. That is national security information. There's a lot of other chemicals on here that could be classified as secure national security information, because if this information is released and there's nothing in this bill to secure that data, it could provide an easy access for a terrorist attack. So there's some major problems with this bill that I believe need to be taken care of.
Representative Hornstein, you want to respond?
Well, Mr.
To that?
Chair, there are issues with 4.13 through 4.19. I'm aware of that. There's also some federal preemption issues. I've talked with the railroads. I think there's a way we can address at least the intent, and I certainly don't want to go to civil law. So at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, either now or at the end of the hearing, I would move to delete that from the bill, that section that was just addressed by Mr. Johnson, so that we don't have to debate that anymore.
So the
amendment would be to delete page 4, lines 13 through 19. Or I'm sorry, it goes actually to 21.
Problem. All right, the chair would move to delete lines 4.13 through lines 4.21. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Mr. Johnson, are you through? Okay. Representative Cornish, did you have any more questions?
No.
Comments?
Sure. I'm good.
Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be as quick as possible. And I appreciate Mr. Brown and Mr. Qualley for their testimony today. And, you know, Representative Hornstein, I think this is a really good bill, too. And I come from a railroad town, and I live in a railroad town. And, you know, I just want to talk about, we've talked a lot about the public safety, the emergency response, and, you know, the fire and EMTs and all of that. One of the things we haven't talked about, though, and my concern is this, and Mr. Brown and Mr. Qualley touched on a little bit, is the condition and the safety of the cars and the rail. And I know for a fact that we have had a terrible winter. That's no surprise to anybody in here. And I know for a fact that there have been companies, rail companies, that have said, and members, maybe you don't think that, you know, the rails don't need to be plowed when it snows, but they do, because it affects the braking system. I have said, and members, maybe you don't think that, you know, the rails don't need to be plowed when it snows, but they do, because it affects the braking system with the engineers and the conductors and the locomotives. And some companies this year have said, you know what, we're just going to let it sit. And that's a safety concern, along with the cars that are on the rail as well. So Representative Hornstein, I would encourage you to include a discussion with Mr. Qualley and Mr. Brown about the conditions of the rail and upkeep of the rail from the rail companies, along with the cars. And I won't carry it on any further, but I would ask you to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm just, with the administration of this, when we're looking at the formula for how this is going to be assessed to the railroads and the pipeline companies, and we're charging DPS with the administration of that, do they have the capacity, or how are they looking at working through this? And does that require another fiscal note in addition to the dollars being spent? Are we able to administer this?
Mr. Waltz. We have someone from DPS.
Mr. Chair, Mark Danaski, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Public Safety.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, representatives, we have been working with the author on this, and as he has said, and as a number of other testifiers have said, we're still working through some of the issues associated with the bill. One of the things that was earlier talked about was routing this through the fire safety account. And through the fire safety account, a lot of the work distributing this, whether it's through grants or through reimbursements, to go through that process. As far as the number of how the process is going to work, if you look at the bill, it really is kind of open for us to start looking at it now to determine how we're going to do it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Would you like that answer? Representative Kelly.
I don't even know what to ask.
Mr. Chair. We're still working on the fiscal note for this bill, so I wish I had a definitive answer as to what it's going to cost and what the Department of Public Safety thinks the resources necessary to manage this program are. We just haven't finished the fiscal note yet, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and thank you for the answer. I know this is it would take some time to get together, but Mr. Chair, I don't know if we have an open checkbook here now in our committee to say whatever it costs, we'll cover it, but. That's concerning that we don't have a fiscal note and pass it out.
It is. Representative Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein, and maybe Commissioner. My concern lies with where this money is being deposited to. I'm starting to have more concern because I don't understand exactly how portable the money is going to be from that account to the things that we're going to need to use it for. When we went, I thought there was used to be three emergency response teams. There used to be five, and now we're down to one. I mean, houses aren't burning down at the same rate they used to 75 years ago. It's about emergency response to hazardous materials, car crashes, medical incidences, etc. And it seems like we're trimming back on the things that we need. I know that we had a state-funded task force out of St. Paul through several departments for structural collapse that we've trimmed back on funding as well. So the things that we need more of, we're not funding. All I want to do is make sure that if we need more emergency response teams and we have that money available, that it goes into the right place, that we can get it to use for what we need it for as a whole. And I may be saying something that you're already thinking of. I just think that we need to have a good, solid discussion about where the money goes. I like the money. And I like the investment. It needs to happen. So that's just my concern there, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that in other areas we just say that it can only be a portion of the amount that we allocate, and I don't think that this should be any different. So even if it comes back with a cost, it should be taken out of the amount, and then there's no fiscal cost to this committee or to the fund.
I think my preference would be to move the bill along and let Representative Hornstein work with others to try to answer the question, to work with the appropriate people to try to fix the questions that members legitimately have, including the chair. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just one last comment on this bill. I understand the concept of this and the need for training of especially of the rural firefighters, because that's where most of this, if something's going to happen, most likely it's going to happen in the rural areas. But this bill also shows the need that never figured I'd be able to say it, but it shows the need for the Keystone Pipeline.
Oh, now we're
Mr. Chair, I'll second that.
Okay. Representative Hornstein, any closing comments? I don't see any other questions. Does anybody from the audience wish to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill that didn't already? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I guess here we go. Representative Slocum, morning, I think Chair. You might have to do yours this afternoon.
That's fine.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I just wanted to make a few comments. First, to extend my appreciation to Representative Hornstein for being willing to visit with us and discuss the various bills and changes that might be made to make them more workable. The provision that he made the motion on or offered to make the motion on earlier, we discussed as one where we have problems both in terms of practicality. This is the 24-hour notice. Workability, practicality, and also issues of federal preemption with both Surface Transportation Board regulation as well as Homeland Security regulations. I would like to point out that BNSF Railway is in favor of a very robust training program for local firefighters and emergency responders. We and the other railroads have been providing that training on a routine basis for many years. In the past few years, we've trained more than 700 emergency responders in the state of Minnesota. We had training classes last fall in the Twin Cities area, as well as in Fargo. We are very supportive of training. We offer it willingly to the communities, information as well. One thing I would, with regard to the grant program, if somehow there could be some sort of inventory of the equipment and materials that are currently available. For example, BNSF Railway and Canadian Pacific Railway both have foam fire trailers in the Twin Cities area. We have another one in the Fargo-Moorhead area. So as part of the process of deciding who would be receiving grants, if there could be some sort of inventory of what other materials are out there to help with the decision making. Also, the rail industry has signed a letter of agreement with USDOT to develop a training curriculum for hazardous materials. So the curriculum portion of the legislation, if somehow that could dovetail with that, and that's something certainly that we can take up in later discussions. Comments were made about the rail equipment, the so-called 111 cars. The rail industry is also in favor of phasing those out as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, that requires a rulemaking by the United States Department of Transportation. Railroads do not own the tank cars that the oil is shipped in. We have been pushing very aggressively to have the oil put in the newer, safer cars. We've even my company's taken the step of saying that we're willing to buy 5,000 cars built even beyond that that standard in the interest of providing safety, that providing even greater safety. With that, I'd be willing to happy to accept any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sweeney? Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Franklin, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I'll be very, very brief. Every point that I was going to make has already been discussed and talked about. We are in general support. I want to just say that on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the firefighters, the people that have responded, I've been in this business for over 40 years. I'm certified in all three areas of emergency management, fire, and law enforcement. I'm proud of what has been done in the state and what the men and women sitting behind me have done. It's a team effort, and I think we can magnify what we've done in the past and grow it. This is a start. This is a good start. I have concerns with regards to the fire safety account, how that's being handled. Law enforcement is left out. EMS and others are left out. This is fixable. I want to encourage us to move forward, but I'm proud of what has been done. I think we should all be giving some compliments and trying to move this forward. I think it'll make Minnesota much better prepared in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Horst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the testimony, and I've heard the concerns very loud and clear, and I commit to work with you, Mr. Chair, and others who've expressed the two basic concerns, one relating to the fire safety account, the second related to expanding the scope of funding for the broader emergency response community. So those are the two issues that I think really came up today. There were a few others, and I will work on those with members and stakeholders. We have time, but not much, to do that.
Thank you. The chair will renew his motion to recommend that House File 3134, as amended, be recommended as referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance, is what I'm trying to say. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Slocum will hear your bill unless you Can the members stay? There's one more bill that I have testifiers on, 3123. We need to come back here this afternoon anyway.
Let's do that.
Okay.
I'm used to being at the back of the bus.
You'll be first in line at 4 o'clock. We are in recess.
Public Safety Committee is reconvening.
Super.
Representative Slocum, you want to introduce your bill?
Good. I got one of these already. Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House File 2574 goes somewhere.
Judiciary.
To Judiciary. Okay. He moved on to Judiciary. How was that for? In the
sounds
realm of
good.
The real. Okay.
Can you tell us what the bill does?
I will. This is a very simple and non-controversial bill in the spirit of the un-session. It strengthens clarifying predatory offender registration requirements and criminal sexual conduct clarification. It is the policy bill for the Department of Public Safety. Individuals who commit certain violent conduct are required by law to register as a predatory offender. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, maintains the central repository of information about these predatory offenders and assists local law enforcement and probation agencies with supervision of these individuals. This proposal requests several changes to assist this supervision and treat predatory offenders in a consistent manner. The proposal also addresses a portion of the criminal code where the description of the crime also contains a penalty for two different crimes, so it clarifies. And I have a testifier here who is an expert. She is Katie Engler, and she's the senior legal analyst with the BCA.
Ms. Engler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I will walk you through the bill. Section 1 makes several changes to registration requirements for predatory offenders. At the bottom of page 1, right now, in two different sections, there is a limitation that you register if you solicited a minor to engage in prostitution, but those two sections contain other criminal conduct that the proposed change would now include as being a basis for registration. On page 2, there's another change where we're including all of the references in, I'm sorry, it's on the bottom of page 1, all references to engaging in sexual conduct with children. The specific reference right now is a limitation. The expansion would include things like engaging in communication with a child related to or describing sexual conduct and distributing material that relates to or describes sexual conduct to a child. Turning to page 2, we have two changes. Right now, Minnesota offenders are currently required to register if they are convicted for an offense that either is on the list or are convicted for an offense that arises out of the same set of circumstances. The bill would make parallel the language for federal violations, military justice violations, and out-of-state offenders. This proposal is in response to a state Court of Appeals case, which found that an out-of-state offender did not need to register because his conviction was not for one of the predatory offenses on the list. And there is a change in line 2.27 that is the first of several to add back a reference to the previous civil commitment statute for sexually dangerous persons and sexually psychopathic personalities. And we're doing this to try to mitigate litigation that those individuals bring over registration requirements. Section 2, the only change is that cross-reference addition. and it is on the bottom of page 4. Section 3 updates a reference to how fingerprints are currently captured. They're now done electronically rather than on a paper card. It adds those cross-references in and expands the authority of those supervising predatory offenders to take a photograph of the offender at any time and of any offender. Currently, only level 3 offenders are required to be photographed, and offenders are only assigned a risk level following incarceration in a correctional facility. Level 3 offenders are only 7% of all of the individuals currently registered with the Predatory Offender Registration Unit. There's additional authority for a supervising agent or officer to have contact with an offender that is expanded in 2 additional places, along with updating the cross-reference. This will give law enforcement and supervising agents more flexibility in dealing with offenders. Section 4 updates 2 cross-references, changes a verb to reflect the practice that a conviction for failure to register always extends the registration period, and changes some language regarding the way people are, if they have another offense, when their incarceration occurs related to that new offense, may or may not trigger an extension of their registration period. And so the proposed change in 8.16 and 8.17 would make all offenders treated consistently, whether they served their time before they were sentenced, in other words, after their arrest and before posting bail, with those who currently under the statute, if they are sentenced for post-conviction time, that their registration period restarts. Sections 5 and 6 are related and are the criminal sexual conduct clarification referenced by Representative Slocum. Section 5 removes penalty language from the description of the offense, and Section 6 places the penalty language with the other penalty language for third-degree criminal sexual conduct. The current intertwined language causes problems at charging and sentencing because not clear which offense is being charged or sentenced. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Are there any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor of the bill or in opposition to the bill? Okay, then. Representative Slocum, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, it's a good bill. Vote for it.
Representative Slocum renews the motion. The House file 2574 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Just wait one second. This, where'd she go? Just want to make sure we're doing that right. Sorry, Laura. Can't function without her. I just want to make sure does this go to Judiciary? Okay, it is going. So it's going to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Engler.
Thank you.
Ms. Slocum. Okay, I'm going to just do my bill from here, if you don't mind, since I have testifiers and it's... what I'd like to do is to introduce the bill. And I think we'll just have some discussion before I introduce the amendment also. But if I could get Mr. Kane and Mr. Stewart and Mr. Hasse to come up, and then we'll explain the bill, and then we'll go through the amendment, because I see some issues with that. And then I would like to sort of take the time to talk to Representative Cornish and at this point, depending on what the committee would like to do, it would probably be my intent to lay the bill over. In some ways it's a complicated bill, in other ways it isn't. But let's just take the testimony first, and then we'll encompass is that. Are we getting the right? Okay. And we don't have a lot of members here also. But members, I'm bringing you, bringing forth House File 3123. And the reason I'm doing this is that we have had a lot of discussions in this legislature about drug offenses, about sentencing, about the spike in prison population due to our increased sentences for drugs, sales, possession, and the mandatory minimums. It's a controversial issue nationally as well as here in the state of Minnesota. As you may know, and probably know, the federal government is not prosecuting a lot of the sort of kingpin cases that are going on now. And we have people from the County Attorneys Association that probably attest to this, that that some of those cases are now being dumped into the laps of our county attorneys throughout the state of Minnesota. This bill attempts to do two things, really. It says that we're actually increasing the penalties for drug kingpins. So we're recognizing that those offenders, those cartel members, if you will, those individuals that are selling large quantities of drugs should be incarcerated for longer periods of time. But the bill is also recognizing that both on possession and sale statutes that our drug laws on first and second degree drug offenses are way out of whack proportionately to the offense, and they're out of whack in Minnesota compared to other states. And it's trying to bring, I think, some common sense to our drug sentencing. So the kingpins go away for longer periods of time. Those who might be, for instance, an addict who are selling a small amount of cocaine or heroin to feed their own addiction would be less apt to be going to prison. So that's what... that's what the bill intends to do. I think that there is a paradigm shift going on in this country in a bipartisan way. I don't see this as... it's my hope that this bill would fix some of these problems. It's a good first step. So with that, I would like to ask for some testimony, both in support of the bill as well as in opposition to the bill. So I'm going to move House File 3123, and then ask, I don't know who wants to take the first, Mr. Hasse.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hasse. I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice. Mr. Chair, would you like me to do a quick walkthrough?
That would be helpful.
It actually will be a summary, and if there are questions about how some of these sentences actually play out, I think Mr. Stewart would probably be a better person to answer those. After doing a quick summary, I will talk about a couple things that I wanted to mention to frame the bill a little bit. So Section 1 eliminates mandatory minimum sentences when the prior offense was a state adjudication sentence. In other words, when somebody receives a state adjudication for a drug sentence, a drug offense, it's typically or first-time lower-level offenses. Currently, if there's a subsequent offense, there's a mandatory minimum that prevents the judge from giving the sentence that seems appropriate to the judge based on the offender's history and amenability to probation. Section 2 increases the threshold amounts for first-degree drug sales and adds 200 or more marijuana plants to first-degree drug sales. Section 3 increases the threshold amounts for first-degree drug possession crimes. Section 4 increases the amounts for the threshold amounts for second-degree drug sales. Section 5 increases the threshold amounts for second-degree drug possession and adds 100 or more marijuana plants to that offense. Section 6 increases the threshold amounts for third-degree drug sales. Section 7 increases the threshold amounts for third-degree drug possession and adds 50 or more marijuana plants to that offense. Section 8 creates the drug kingpin statute that Mr. Representative Paymar referenced. Section 7 requires the chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to be a public member. Section 10 creates staggered terms for members of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And Section 11 requires the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to develop sentencing criteria based on the proportionality of the offense. In other words, how the offense, whether various criteria and whether the offense is proportionate, or the sentence is proportionate to other offenses. Two things I wanted to present to frame this a little bit, and Representative Paymar, you referenced at least, I think, both of them, but I wanted to give a little more detail. One is the comparison to other states. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission created a report on Minnesota drug sentencing in 2004 and then updated it in 2007. And some of these other states may have changed some of their sentences, but to my knowledge, reforms in this area have only reduced sentences. I'm not aware of any in these particular states, but Minnesota's sentences have stayed the same. And I'm going to read from a couple things from the report. So the commission compared the most serious drug offenses in several jurisdictions. The amount of controlled substance an offender must possess in order to trigger the most severe punishment, which would be in Minnesota first-degree drug sales, in Minnesota is generally far less than in other Midwestern states. In Iowa, for example, a seller of methamphetamines would have to possess 500 times more than in Minnesota, a powder cocaine seller 50 times more, a crack seller 5 times more. The severity of our drug punishments is compounded by the fact that Minnesota presumes offenders are sellers if they possess the threshold amount. In most jurisdictions, X constituting sale must be proven. So just to give some of the numbers, in Minnesota, the most serious sale offense for methamphetamines, powder cocaine, and crack cocaine requires 10 grams. In Illinois, and I have a graph here, and it would be nice to have copies of this, but you can sort of see Minnesota just barely has a bar on the graph. It's right at the bottom. And then you get to Illinois, and the threshold amount is 900 grams. Iowa, from 1,000 to probably, it looks like about maybe 20 grams here for crack cocaine, a lower amount. Michigan, 1,000 grams for powder and crack. North Dakota, 50 grams for meth, powder cocaine, and a lower 5 for crack cocaine. And Wisconsin, 50 grams for meth, 40 for powder, and 40 for crack. Just wrapping that up, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission also compared the example of somebody selling 10 grams of cocaine with no prior record. In Minnesota, that individual would get a presumed over 80-month sentence. Illinois, a little over 40 months. New York, about 10 months. Oregon, about 18 months. Texas, 60 months. Washington, about 10 or 12 months. And the federal... Under federal law, looks like about 10 or 12 months on the graph. Remember, Minnesota is over 80 months for that same offense. So that's how we compare. I have testified on other issues about the collateral consequences and how Minnesota sort of our incarceration and conviction rates play out. You've heard that Minnesota has the lowest or second to lowest incarceration rate in the country. But when you look at our overall rate of population under some kind of correctional control, we have the eighth highest in the country. And that's because, on these sentences, we do judiciously sentence people to prison, but we give people very long probation terms. and those have a lot of consequences that go with them as well as the prison terms, including, you know, another issue you've heard about, which is, you know, vastly increasing numbers of people being disenfranchised. The racial disparities have greatly increased over the last 30 years because of this drug sentencing. So that's the comparison to other states. The other thing I wanted to touch on is what you mentioned, Mr. Chair, the change on this, these issues nationally, change in the politics on this. A recent Vera Institute report cites that since 2000, at least 29 states have taken steps to roll back mandatory sentences, with 32 bills passed in just the last 5 years. There is currently a bipartisan act in Congress. It's called the Justice Safety Valve Act of 2013. That authorizes judges to depart from a mandatory minimum sentence. A group of more than 50 former federal prosecutors and judges has signed on in support of that bill. It's authored by Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Democrat Bobby Scott in the House and Virginia, and Republican Thomas Massey of Kentucky in the House. And, you know, they of course, they're not endorsing this particular legislation here in Minnesota, but referring to the sentence, the Justice Safety Valve Act of 2013, they said dangerous criminals will continue to receive lengthy prison sentences. That would still be true under this. In fact, there may be longer sentences for those under that kingpin section. And then I like this quote from the prosecutor's, former prosecutor's letter. We believe that the money wasted on keeping nonviolent and non-threatening offenders locked behind bars for years longer than necessary could be better spent on anti-crime programs that actually will enhance public safety. Public safety will be improved if limited government resources are targeted on prosecuting and incarcerating violent and repeat criminals. And the Justice Safety Valve Act and a general shift in saving government resources, using alternative sentencing, alternative treatment programs for nonviolent drug offenders, has really, the support for that has really shifted from groups like Right on Crime. And in this press release, it cites supporting the Justice Safety Valve Act are George Will, David Keene of the National Rifle Association, Grover Norquist, the National Association of Evangelicals, and Justice Fellowship. So nationally, there really, as Mr. Chair, there's been a real shift on how folks are looking at how we've handled drug offenders. And none of them are saying there should not be consequences for drug offenses. What they're saying is that sometimes those consequences are too long, create too much of a negative impact on families and our communities, are necessarily helpful for rehabilitation, and just waste a lot of money. That's the conclusion of my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. I should know the answer to this, but I don't, so I'm going to ask Mr. Diebel, since he drafted the bill. I just want to know the provision, the aggravated controlled substance provision, I think it's Section 8 of the bill. We're now increasing the penalties here. This is the kingpin's provision to 40 years and 50 years for subsequent conviction. What is it currently for that quantity of sale?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Hoskins, Stewart.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I may, I'm John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. Right now, there isn't any difference between somebody that sells 10 grams of a drug and somebody that sells a ton. There was a case in Wilmer, Minnesota, of 12,000 grams of methamphetamine that was turned down by the federal courts. The state court prosecutors got it. And that person who had the 12,000 grams is getting the same presumed sentence as somebody with 10 grams. That's part of the logic of this bill that you've authored, is that it puts drug offenders in prison, but it sort of reshapes the use of the resources so that the people who are dealing the heavier weights are going to get more time. Okay, and the little fish are going to get a break, frankly.
So as long as you have the mic, why don't you present your comments, and then we'll have Mr. Kane talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. I'm also a member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but I'm not testifying on behalf of or about the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I just don't think that would be appropriate for me as a member. I will say I've been working on drug thresholds since that first report came out from the commission in 2004, and it's been a hard 10 years. This is an area where here it's very hard to make progress. 29 other states have found that it's more cost-effective to reshape how they use their resources in dealing with drug offenders, but we have not done that. And I've been on the Controlled Substance Working Group, and I've been on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and we've had a lot of real close votes about maybe making some changes, but it's been hard to make changes. Nevertheless, I believe that this is a really good bill that deserves to pass this year, because during this 10 years, while this has been being discussed here in Minnesota, there have been a lot of things that have changed in the outside world. First of all, we've had the development of evidence-based practices, and people can see now what actually is effective in reducing repeat offenses. That's something that we didn't have when we discussed this. And nationally, in these 29 states that have reshaped their drug sentencing, there has been tremendous cost savings and no detriment to public safety. We've confirmed this effect with two studies in Minnesota. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission did a study of 2,000 offenders in two groups, totally matched for age, race, gender, offense, criminal history, and followed them to see what happened to the people who went to prison for drug crimes and what happened to people who had probation, local jail time, treatment, and supervision. And the people that didn't go to prison had less repeat offending, less recidivism than the people who were in prison. The people that were sent to prison turned out worse. The drug court study in Minnesota has shown that the drug courts have reduced recidivism by about a third, depending on what group of people that you follow, whether you follow the people that enter the drug court or the people that graduate. Even the people that enter it and don't graduate have a reduced recidivism rate compared to people that go through the state track. And I know that some of you, members of your committee are from counties that have successful drug courts, and they probably could see this in their own experience. I also want to say that there has been a concern about resources that has been brought up by the Right on Crime group. Right now, if you sell 10 grams of cocaine in Minnesota, this is an amount that has a street value of about $1,200. 10 grams, about $1,200. For a first offender, the presumed sentence is 7 years and 2 months in prison. And this prison costs the taxpayers about $35,000 a year. So you might have a choice whether you would want to put that person behind bars for 7 years, or more realistically, 5 years considering parole. But are you going to spend $180,000 on somebody that sold $1,000 or $1,200 worth of a drug? There's also a proportionality issue, because this sentence of 7 years and 2 months is the same sentence that you get for first-degree manslaughter, where you intentionally kill somebody in the heat of passion. I think if you ask most people what is more serious, first-degree manslaughter or selling $1,000 worth of cocaine, most people would pick the manslaughter, but they're in the same box on our chart. One other thing that has happened in the outside world, besides these changes in the 29 other states, besides the development of evidence-based practices, besides more of an understanding of proportionality, one thing that's happened is that the federal court system got a big whack to their budget. And as a result of this, as Mr. Hasse indicated, the federal district courts are not taking big drug cases that they used to take. So, for instance, I've been in two hearings now with Deputy County Attorney Phil Prokopowicz from Dakota County. He's got seven cases on his desk now of over a pound. Now, as I quickly do the math, a pound is in the area of around maybe 900 grams, okay? But those people that are moving a pound are in the same sentencing zone as the people who are sitting in a bar selling 10 grams to their friend. Not that that's a good thing to do. The recommendation is not to let them go, but not to have quite as high a sentence for that relatively small amount. That's why there is a kingpin provision in here. There's a section for people that have 200 marijuana plants. There's a section for people who sell 100 grams. You know, I've been talking to the county attorneys about this for a month, and I'm not quite sure what they want to do about the kingpins. I'm not sure what a kingpin is to them. To me, I don't really like people selling 100 grams of methamphetamine. That to me seems like a lot. It might be $10,000 worth. And for that person to have a higher sentence even than the first degree drug sentence now, I think that would be appropriate if that person is selling in those large quantities. I'm concerned as a public defender, I'm concerned about the addicted person who is the little guy in this chain of fish, you know, the small fish here. Is consuming too many correctional resources compared to the benefits that the public gets out of putting that little fish in prison.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Before Mr. Kane takes a Commissioner, before we get to anything dealing with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, would you like to address the bill? You don't have to, but if you...
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the invitation very much, but I was going to comment on the sentencing guidelines.
Is that the provision you wanted to? Okay, yes. Very good. I misunderstood that.
I'm not sure where that's going.
Okay, well, I'm not sure either, so. Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Kane. I am the president of an organization called RS Eden that provides correctional services, housing services, substance abuse treatment, accountability monitoring, drug testing, and a coffee shop. My testimony here, though, relates more to a role I filled about 30 years ago, actually 25 years ago, as a member and later chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I was originally appointed in 1982 by Governor Cui, later reappointed by Governor Perpich and made chair. And the testimony that I'm going to offer relates to Section 8, 9, and 10 of the bill. The modified change in Minnesota Statutes 244 in Section 8 simply state that the chair of the commission will be appointed from the three public members. The governor has the authority to appoint the chair. Two of the first three chairs were public members. The reason for that, the middle chair was a county attorney, Steve Rathke. And in the midst of his term, he determined that since the criminal justice system was an adversarial system, that the chair should be someone who didn't have an obvious interest in swaying the system one way or another. Since 1990, virtually all the chairs have been from law enforcement or prosecution. based upon the success in the early guidelines and the presumed neutrality of the public member, there are three members that are public members of the seven that are appointed by the governor. This changes it so that his choices or her choices are limited to one of the public members. The modifications under section 10, relate to the terms of the commission members. Prior to 1987, commission member terms were staggered. In 1997, the legislature saw fit to make all commission terms coterminous with the governor. That means that after hiring the Commissioner of Corrections, fully 8 of the 11 members of the commission could overturn and did in 1990 with the swipe of a pen, with one gubernatorial appointment. This change in Section 9 suggests that beginning in January 1st, 2015, that members will be appointed for either 4-year or 2-year terms, and then every reappointment thereafter will be 4-year terms, so that we maintain continuity on the commission, that there isn't a total wholesale overturn, and so that one particular governor, frankly, unless he's elected for a second term, only gets to appoint half the commission. The third modification relates to Section 11, and it directs the commission to appoint to develop a system that would assure and measure proportionality in sentencing. One of the original goals of 244, along with equity and certainty of sentencing. And much of this work was done in the late 80s and in 1990, but as I mentioned, it was scrapped when there was a wholesale overhaul of the commission. Basically, what this does is it requires the commission or directs the commission to develop a system, a numerical system, an objective system, if you will, that measures the interest being protected by a statute, the type of harm inherent within that particular statute, the level of harm inherent in the particular subsection that's being prosecuted, and the culpability of the offender. Now, you might say, don't we already do that? Well, yes and no. I mean, you all have been here long enough to see situations where a particular heinous crime comes along, a bill is passed, it's ranked, and it may or may not necessarily fit in a scheme of things, making it proportional to other crimes. Public Defender Stewart has already mentioned the fact that sale of 10 grams of a drug under current guidelines will get you the same sentence as first-degree manslaughter. There are a number of other areas in the guidelines where that degree of disproportionality exists. This particular provision would not bind the commission to ranking drugs according to the analysis once they have developed and measured the objective criteria, but it would require them to say why they don't. It would require them, much in the way that the original sentencing legislation was, it would require them to say why something isn't ranked proportional. Now, there are obviously crimes and situations that may warrant that. So, as I said, they have that freedom, but it does create a template, if you will, that will say, you know, a crime that commits that's against a person that has this level of harm and this type of harm and this culpability of the offender will be sentenced proportionate to other drugs that share those characteristics. So that's, I'll take questions.
Mr. Cannon, have you had a chance to review the A1 amendment?
I have. I think that there are, I think the A1 amendment improves the language of the, you know, this was written hastily and then put together. The part on page 7, line 10, that requires that the commission review all current rankings in light of the established criteria and submit any revised ranking deemed appropriate to the legislature by January 1st. That was not something that was in the original bill. I still think it's a good addition. The only thing I would suggest that we add on page 7, where we've deleted lines 22 and 24, we list type of harm, level of harm, and culpability of harm. I think that we should also add the interest being protected by the statute, whether or not it's societal, individual, personal, economic, you know, those present a different level of of harm to the public. And after all, that's what we're measuring, is harm to the public.
Commissioner, do you want to respond to this section of
I might want to add, I'm sorry, I apologize, Mr. Chair, but much of this work, as I said, has already been done. It certainly needs to be reviewed, modified, updated, and whatever. So,
but are you okay with the amendment?
Yes.
Commissioner Roy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. When I first read Subdivision 11, I was very concerned about the ability of the Guidelines Commission to actually quantify harm with this language that was originally in there. The amendment language certainly appears to be more doable and relates to some descriptions that exist in statute already in terms of culpability, and certainly that word is prevalent throughout the guidelines. I think this would be a major undertaking for the Guidelines Commission. As a member of that commission, I would be concerned about the timing, if it could actually be accomplished within that framework, especially since there will be a new executive director of the Guidelines Commission coming on within the next month or two, hopefully. Director Mitchell, who is behind me, has submitted her resignation. I'm not sure if people know that. But it certainly is going to distract the work of the commission for a while. And it's also tough to put human behavior in numerical boxes. And I know Mr. Kane has a high expectation that this numerical system of grading harm will bring more proportionality, but it will be difficult work, and I hope the commission is up to it if this amendment is actually included in the final bill.
Very good. Any questions of the commissioner?
Thank you, Commissioner Roy.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from, I assume the County Attorneys Association must have a position on this. Or anybody else who would like to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill. Mr. Kingery, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Kingery, testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We have had previous discussions and saw a previous draft of this bill, and it was reviewed by our criminal law committee and board last month, and took the passed the following motion. I'm also going to go in and just briefly summarize the 2009 working group report as well, because it references that. The board voted to support the recommendations of the 2009 working group on controlled substances and to add a kingpin provision, which your bill does. And the motion continued that if the bill is going to advance, that the board would appoint a group of elected county attorneys to work on particular specific provisions of the bill. And that motion was passed last month.
Well, Mr. Kingery, what does that mean?
What's that mean? Mr. Chairman, if I could go through and then I'm sure we'll have a discussion on what that means. I think a number of you were around, and certainly a number of people in the room around, when the 2008 legislature appointed a working group on controlled substances. It met over many months, had a number of close votes, and I'll just briefly summarize some of the recommendations. They recommended a number of changes that were consistent with public safety, including a marijuana grow stat section, which your bill does have. The federal government counts growing plants, and they do that because when you go in and bust a growing operation, you may have 200 or 300 plants, and they'll probably weigh a couple ounces. And when they become big plants, they weigh a lot more than that. But a lot of times when they're busted, they're very, very small plants. And so this is certainly a positive change to our current statute. The reductions at that time in the marijuana thresholds, and with responsible increases in some of the cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin thresholds. And I'll just briefly describe that right now. With regard to the cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin thresholds, for first degree, the current for first degree, it's currently at 25 grams for possession. The working group recommended 35 for sale. It again, first degree, 10 grams. The working group recommended 10 for second degree, 6 grams. The working group recommended 10 for second degree sale, 3 grams, and the final recommendation was 5 grams. I do want to say for the record, though, that there were basically three proposals that went forward that were under serious discussion by the Controlled Substance Work Group. The law enforcement proposal, what was called the defense bar proposal, and the third proposal, which was kind of a combination of the two. And I would like to say for the record that the proposal that is currently in your bill is less than the defense proposal in 2009 and less than the third proposal that was in 2009. It's substantially lower than what was on the table at that time. They recommended no separate sentencing grid for controlled substances. They did support a kingpin classification, but were unable to reach a consensus on the definition of a kingpin. Increase early release for nonviolent drug offenders who complete treatment. That's a very, very general summary of what the Controlled Substances Working Group recommended. And as I said, or as I indicated earlier, the board has identified a group which we've communicated with you that is willing to sit down and have a discussion on where and if we move on this particular issue.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Mr. Franklin, you could just stay there, Mr. Kingray, so we can...
Mr. Chairman,
if
I could just say one more thing. I do want you are what your one of your earlier statements about, or was it John Stewart? I don't recall that the federal government is taking fewer and fewer of these cases. So we are seeing more of the larger amounts in our state courtrooms, and that certainly is a problem, and that speaks to our desire to have a kingpin statute.
Well, maybe Mr. Kingray, I just ask you, like, does the County Attorneys Association believe, I don't know if you can say this, does the County Attorneys Association believe that we have a problem in the state of Minnesota, that our laws are disproportionate compared to other states, that that this legislature or the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, which doesn't seem to be able to act, has the responsibility to deal with this issue? In your discussions, I mean, I know we're not at we're not in agreement on the levels of the thresholds, but
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we certainly recognize that there is a controlled substance problem in Minnesota. I believe by the fact that we did collectively, all of us came together and with that working group and came up with some modest recommendations and a willingness to continue that discussion, I think does speak that we I don't know if I would use the word problem, but that we are willing to have these discussions with you and the public policymakers in looking at the threshold amounts.
Thank you, Mr. Gangrene.
Too much to answer.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cornish.
Question for Mr. Kingery. If there was a Kingfish statute defined, how many people do you think would be available for prosecution or prosecuted under it a year?
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cornish, I really don't know. I'm not sure. Sentencing guidelines might have an idea. I would think they would have some sort of a number, or possibly with the within the court system, they might have some numbers, but I don't know. I don't believe it's a high number, Representative Cornish, but again, with more and more of these, with the feds taking fewer and fewer of these cases, they are showing up, and first degree for these cases is pretty light if it's a substantial amount.
Thank you, Mr. Kingery. Mr. Kingery? You have a question of Mr. Kingery? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question. We've heard a number of times that someone who's convicted with a small amount of these substances would end up doing the same type of jail sentence as someone that's convicted of manslaughter. My question is, of those people that are convicted with the small amounts of controlled substance, how many of those people actually served the full 7 years? I mean, just give me a ballpark figure. I mean, just because you're sentenced, that doesn't mean you spend that amount of time in jail.
Mr. Kingery?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think what I will say is what I hear. I can't give you a specific number, but for most drug offenses, for most of them, you get a stay of adjudication on a first possession sale. I'm not so sure on. I just 152.18. I'm less certain about sale. But what I constantly hear from our prosecutors is individuals that are going to jail for drugs, either possession or sale. It's their second, third, and fourth offense. And that final offense, many times there's a gun involved, and they've had multiple chances. At least this is what I constantly hear from our prosecutors, is these are not, overwhelmingly, these are not first-time offenses. They've had 2, 3, 4, 5 offenses before they are finally incarcerated.
And Representative Neuberger, I want Mr. Stewart, after Mr. Franklin testifies, to respond to that also, just to balance here. Mr. Franklin, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. For the record, Jim Franklin, Executive Director from the Sheriff's Association, speaking today sort of on behalf of law enforcement, if I will. As you know, we take a little different stance, a little more conservative approach to this issue. The county attorneys are always dragging us along, saying we have to get the step here a little bit closer, so we try to work in tandem with them as best we can. I will not go through the things that John has already gone through. He's done an excellent job. I would just say this. We're obviously opposed to the amount issues and the increases. It simply means more buys, more product, more money, more danger, more problems, and more chances of somebody getting hurt. Bottom line. Secondly, I've already heard from our two labs, Hennepin and Anoka, concerns about increases in testing and other kinds of things. What do? We're going to send more to the BCA. It's going to be more of a cost issue if we do this. So those are cost implications with doing business. It's going to take us more buy money, more time in order to comply with all of these things. So we are concerned. The kingpin issue, you've already addressed that. It is a concern. Mr. Chairman, with all due respect and to your point, more times than not, I've heard in squad rooms and other kinds of things, somebody come back from the trial and said, what happened? Oh, you got another double suspended sentence. I can give you an example of a young man that I lived with me and helped through some troubled times. And you ask the question, you know, can we arrest our way out of this? And I don't think we can. I think we have to do a multitude of things. Arrest is one piece. Education and holding people accountable is another piece. And I can just tell you from my experience with the young man that I worked with in my home, there was not enough penalties along the way, and it was repeated to the point where it finally ended up in jail and in prison again and again.
because he wouldn't learn and listen. And so I think to some degree, as I look back on some of these experiences, had we been more strict, more accountable at a younger age, perhaps we would have avoided some of the consequences. So it's a serious problem. I understand it. I think we want to work together on it, but we do have concerns that I articulated here, and I'll just close with that because in the interest of time. But I think it is something that we need to continue to work on.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Just you brought up costs. I just would ask Mr. Waltz to, if you could just briefly touch on the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, members, a fiscal note was prepared to this bill language before it was introduced, and four agencies were assigned work on the fiscal note. I was told subsequent to that that the BCA may have some costs and be added later to this note and wish to ask for more money for drug sample testing. However, the information that did come back, the only agency that was materially affected by this was the Department of Corrections. They assumed that the first year in 2015 they would need 15 fewer beds and a savings of $203,000. That would grow to 42 fewer beds in 16, a savings of $690,000, and in 17, 66 fewer beds and a savings of $1.23 million. They also did sentencing guidelines, and the Department of Corrections said that this number would continue to grow and level off over the years, but 10 years from now, in 2024, it would be 118 fewer beds and a savings of about $2.5 million a year to the Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. And Mr. Stewart, can you just respond to Representative Neuberger's? Because that's, I have to say, I think we hear these things, and if you want to stay, it doesn't matter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Informational at this point, I think.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, here's the situation as I understand it after hearing these reports of the Guidelines Commission. About a third of the offenders in the state prison system are in there on drug cases. Right now, in the Shakopee Women's Prison, for instance, there are about 660 women, and a little over 200 of them are in there on drug offenses. The sentence of 86 months, that's the 7 years and 2 months, that's the presumed sentence in the guidelines for first-degree drug crime. That's selling of the 10 grams or a possession of 25 grams. There is about a 50% departure in the courts off those sentences. But two things about that. One of them is those people that don't go to prison can get up to 1 year in the county jail as a condition of probation. So there are a lot of people that are sentenced to a year in the county jail, then complete drug treatment, then be supervised for 5 years. Sentences like that are quite common. That person isn't in the prison. The people that are in prison, if they behave themselves on that sentence of 7 years and 2 months, they're entitled to be released on supervised release after about 5 years. It's whatever two-thirds of 86 months is. I think it's 4 years and 10 months. They'd be eligible for supervised release, and then they would be supervised for a couple of years. One issue with those folks is that the Department of Corrections is short of treatment beds and treatment staff compared to what they need for the 10,000 people that they have in custody, many, many, many of whom are chemically dependent. So there's a lot of situations where you're comparing, the person is in jail in the community and then they go to treatment versus they go to, say, St. Cloud Prison and they don't get treatment and then they get out and now they're 5 years older but they haven't had any treatment for their addiction. So there are a lot of variables in this. I have to say honestly to you that it would be pretty rare for a person to do the full 7 years and 2 months. They would have to act up pretty bad. But the normal person that gets that sentence would do about 4 years and 10 months.
Mr. Stewart, Mr. Kingray was talking about, because I do think this is a legitimate issue, and I'm not apologizing to the committee for bringing it up, the bill up, because I believe in the bill, but I you know, we've been trying to negotiate something that makes sense for a long time, and when Mr. Kingray says that what he hears, whether it's anecdotally or he has evidence to state that by the time someone gets sent to prison, that they have committed a crime with a gun, a firearm. Can you respond to that? Because I think we do get a little caught here about when we say nonviolent drug offenders and use that kind of term. Is that, and I don't know that that's true.
Mr. Chair, my recollection of the last study that the commission did on that was that about 4 or 5% of these offenses involve a gun. And I have to say, I hear stories too. I had a mother call me up crying because her daughter, who had just graduated from high school, drove a car for her boyfriend while he sold some drugs, and she ended up getting 4 years in the state prison because that was the best that the county attorney could do for her in negotiation. And the best I could tell this mother, who was on the phone sobbing, I could say, well, if she behaves well in prison, she'll be out in 32 months. 32 months is a long time in prison for an 18-year-old young woman who has a rotten boyfriend, you know. But that's how you get that 200 women in Shakopee. You know, there's a lot of stories on both sides, but the numbers show that a third of the people in the state prisons are there for drug crimes. And so if you could think of something a little more economical to do with them, you would not injure public safety, and you would save some money.
Mr. Kingray?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going on memory, so if I'm wrong, I hope Commissioner Roy comes up and corrects me, but I believe he had a presentation to your committee, I believe last week, and he talked about the increase, the offenses that are driving the increase in the prison population, and my recollection was felony DWI was a big driver, and the drug issue, a lot of the folks that are in there are from methamphetamine offenses, you know, a number of years ago, and so in terms of newer drug offenses, my recollection is those numbers tend to be lower. The meth scourge that we saw, you know, 8 years ago has died down. Regrettably, heroin has risen, but I believe a lot of that was driven by the methamphetamine offenses a number of years ago, and that the driving numbers now have less to do with drugs than they might have 5 or 6 years ago.
Someone else in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any questions of the testifiers? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify a few things. I can't remember which testifier talked about the 900 grams of, I think it was cocaine that one of the prosecutors has on his desk and talked about it just being 1 pound. That is just a fraction shy of 2 pounds. That 900 grams is a very lot of weight of cocaine. It's not just 1 pound. Like I said, it's about 10 one-thousandths of a gram short of, or 10 one-hundredths of a gram short of 2 pounds. It's not often. I sat in court many times, and I had to correct defense attorney. So I do enjoy doing that. Another thing, when they talk about the presumptive sentence of the time for that they spend in prison, I worked narcotics for a year and a half undercover. I When somebody did go to prison, it was never their first offense. A second offense, they usually got, a lot of times, just county time. It was a third or fourth offense before they actually went into the prison, the state prison system. And we did a number of search warrants. 75% of the time we did search warrants, we found firearms. Guns are always involved, just about always involved with narcotics because of the value of the drugs. They're protecting their money. There's many times when they do their sales that they are ripped off, so they're trying to protect their income. Another problem that we have with, especially back when we had the meth monsters, that is what law enforcement called them, because they, you never knew what they were going to do. I had a very massive fight with a female on Thanksgiving Day, and she, because of the amount of methamphetamine she had in her, she had no clue what she was doing, and she was just petrified, and she was fighting for her life, not wanting to go back to prison again while she's doing a burglary. Most of the time with these, when we get them for law enforcement, get these individuals for sales, they might not be able to clear up the 50 burglaries, but we find the stolen property from a bunch of burglaries, and we know, and law enforcement knows they've done 50 to 75, 100 burglaries, but we're unable to prove them in court, but we can get them on that drug conviction. In law enforcement, if we can find any reason to get these people off the street, we're going to use it, because a lot of times these drug people, it's not just the drug crime, it's multiple other crimes that they're doing that they do not get charged with, or if they were charged, it's plea bargained out. As far as this bill goes, there's parts of it that are good. Conforming to the federal with the marijuana plant count is wonderful. I've spent hours and hours every day for a week stripping marijuana plants. I had over a 400 plant grow operation that I stumbled across in a knock and talk. Harvested all, but in order to charge them out, we had to strip every plant, the leaf off every plant, and weigh it to get an amount instead of just being able to count the plants. So counting the plants is much better, much easier for law enforcement, and it conforms what the federal law is. But as far as increasing these numbers for these offenses, it's going to be a danger to the law enforcement community. It's going to be a danger to the public. When these officers do these sales, it's generally not the officers doing the sales anymore or doing the buys. It's the person that an informant that they're getting to do the buys. The more often they do it, the better chance for this person to get injured or hurt, or even worse, because dealing with these people. Then, like they mentioned, it's going to be increased costs to the lab. It's going to increase time and increase the danger for the officers and the people involved in these cases.
Mr. Hossie. Ms. Mitchell, I wonder if you could just come up for one last comment before you retire. I have one question for you also. But Mr. Hossie, do you want to address Representative Johnson? Or?
Well, I wanted to just make one sort of general comment regarding some of the discussion about what happens and what doesn't happen,
okay.
Mr. Chair and members. And I hope that, you know, if there's hopefully there'll be future conversations about this issue when that's done, there's a real good look at the actual numbers. And just one thing I wanted to point out from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission's most recent report is that for first-degree drug offenses, there were 386 of those in 2000. I have an old report. I think, and maybe Ms. Mitchell can speak to some of the more recent trends, but in that year, 67% of those first-degree drug offenders went to prison. Some might say that that's not enough, but 67% is a pretty high percentage in my mind that actually went to prison, didn't get a dispositional departure. And the average sentence length for someone with a zero criminal history was 69 months.
Thank you.
Sorry about the outdated report.
That's okay. Ms. Mitchell, I just have a quick question because I know that I think Mr. Kane's testimony, what we're trying to accomplish here with that provision of the bill also, and I just can't remember from your testimony to the Judiciary Committee as well as this committee about the geographical differences in sentences and why this is an issue. It seems to me that offenders in the metropolitan area, for instance, would get a far less sentence for either sale or possession than they would in greater Minnesota. And I wonder if you could just address that. That's what we were trying to do here in the bill, is to look at that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelly Mitchell, Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And we did study this issue. So just to more generally, you take a step back and answer one of the prior questions and then answer your question off of that. We've noticed a trend that for the past more than a decade, for first-degree offenses, about 30% of offenders are receiving the guidelines sentence. Around 20% go to prison but don't go for as long as the guidelines call for, and the rest are getting a probationary sentence. Second degree has a little bit closer adherence to the guidelines, where there's about 40% of offenders receiving the prison sentence that's on the grid. Then there's a band of offenders who, again, go to prison, but not for as long as the guidelines call for, and then the rest receive probation. So we do have a wide variance from the sentencing guidelines right now. When we look at that by geography, we looked at that by judicial district, and we saw an extreme variation across the state in the rates at which offenders are being given guidelines versus non-guideline sentences. So in the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin, Minneapolis, and the 6th Judicial District, which is Duluth, St. Louis County, about 31% of offenders are receiving the guideline sentence. But in the 8th Judicial District, which is sort of Mankato, it's that band that runs along the 94 but south of it, 81% of offenders are receiving the guideline sentence. So huge difference depending on the culture of the area and what the sentencing practices are. So we did see that big variation, and that was something that really bothered the commission.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner, I believe we asked this question when you were testifying in that hearing about this variance. And we're just wondering if there's much, is part of this deviation in the sentencing guidelines is because of the plea bargain agreements.
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Paymar and Representative Johnson, honestly, plea agreements happen across the grid. So the reality is that if you look at all offenses across the entire set of the guidelines, all felony offenses that are governed by the guidelines, 75% of the time, the guideline sentence is imposed and followed. But for these offenses, we're down to 30%. Plea agreements happen in all of those offenses, all across the criminal justice system. That alone can't be the reason that there is such a wide variation in the departure rate here. It's got to be something else.
Gibson Ward.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And you use your microphone, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, you were and congratulations on your upcoming retirement. Would your variations, deviation from the sentencing, be at all equitable to, or have anything to do with? Somebody mentioned drug courts earlier. We've got a really, really, really good drug court in my district. I've been at a number of graduations, and they really do work. Somebody said we need to find something that's economically smart and wise and makes a lasting impression. The ones that I've seen really work. So does it matter if a judicial district has a drug court or not, or is a functional drug court? Does that at all play a factor?
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Paymar and Representative Ward, not that we can see. Most, I used to actually work on the drug court program when I worked over at the courts. Most drug courts have entrance criteria, yep. and most of them exclude first and second degree offenses as offenses that could go into drug court. Now, there's been a statewide drug court evaluation more recently, and it's been a recommendation to include a greater number of offenders, and so some counties are starting to move in that direction, but But this has been going on far longer than that. So no, these are offenders who are being put on probation, not necessarily into drug court. We studied a particular group of these offenders from 2009 to 2011. We asked the courts how many were in drug court, and only 6% of the offenders in our study were in drug court.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and ma'am, I think we have two separate tracks here. I don't think drug courts have a lot to do with deterrent. I support drug courts. They're a great thing. That's once a crime is already committed. As far as a deterrent, I think the stiffer sentence is a better deterrent than drug court. And then the other question I had is, in your experiences, when they talk about DWIs, they always throw out that figure like for somebody that gets caught first time DWI, it's really not their first time DWI. They probably got by with it 50 times driving to the bars and back. They just got caught. Is it the same with drug offenders, the first offense? Do you think that the one that we think is innocent first-time drug offenders that we're being so rough on, do you think it might be their 10th or 20th time they've done it? It's just that we've gotten lucky and caught them?
Ms. Mitchell?
Chair Paymar and Representative Cornish, I don't have any information that could answer that question.
Representative Cornish, it's probably true in a lot of crimes. You look at domestic violence crimes, you think the first time that someone gets arrested for domestic abuse is the first time they've committed an act of violence against their spouse. Not true.
True.
So I thank you. Any questions, other questions of Ms. Mitchell? Thank you so much, and good luck in your new ventures. Any other comments or questions? I appreciate, members, I just wanted to say this one final thing, and then we'll adjourn till tomorrow. I've set up, do you have a comment first? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just had one more comment on page 7 in line 7.12. We changed the date of the appointments by the governor. With going to January 1st, it's possibility being a week to 2 weeks before a brand new governor would be sworn into office. Now we have the possibility of an exiting governor setting the commission for the next governor. And it'd get to a point where get into a second term before that governor could actually have his policies, start actually pursuing some of his policies on this. So I think keeping it back for appointment, I understand the staggering, but for the appointment back to the way first Monday in January. Yeah, the first Monday, so the new governor would be able to appoint the people that he would feel would best for his policies.
Commissioner's nodding his head too. So it's going to be my intent to lay the bill over if the bill should move in the Senate. And we still have an opportunity to deal with it this legislative session. All of these issues that have been raised, we will certainly take into consideration. I just wanted to say this. I appreciate you members coming back and the testimony. I wished we could make progress on this bill. It's very discouraging for me, having set up the committee in 2009, the working group, and at some point, I hope that we can reach some agreement on this, because what we're, you know, we've had this war on drugs since when was Rockefeller governor of New York? I mean, that was the 70s. And the war on drugs has been a miserable failure, and it will always be a failure. And I don't have the correct answer. Representative Simonson has just gone through a big ordeal with his synthetic drugs committee, and I don't have the answer. I think this bill was taking us in the right step to go after the bigger fish, and to, you know, I guess we'll always have this fight about whether. Representative Johnson, whether some of these offenders have firearms or not, or whether they've committed violent offenses, but we can't keep doing what we're doing. Other states, as the testimony we've heard, other states are rolling back their sentences. The conservative states are doing it. Your own party is taking a very different stand on this, where And I don't know what our party's doing, but but I just I really hope I'm not going to be here. But I hope that I'm not going to be. I just hope that members, in some way, in a bipartisan way, can really make the Sentencing Guidelines Commission work, because I don't think it's working now. The idea was that it was supposed to take the political pressure off of us so they could make these kinds of decisions and we wouldn't have to take the votes, because just like the MSOP issue, that we're stalled, we're not moving because no one wants to see something on the back of their piece of literature that says Representative Paymar just voted to increase the threshold on possession and sale to X amount. I mean, you know, in my district, I think I could probably explain this, but it's hard to explain at the door, and that's the political reality of what we're doing here, and it's wrong. And so, Commissioner, if you're here, next term, terms ahead, you're going to continue to see that spike in prison population. We're now renting out 3,500 beds this year. How many are we going to be renting out in the years ahead? How many new wings are you going to be putting on prisons in the state of Minnesota? Who's going to pay for that, and at what cost? I don't know why I'm just staring at you. but that's... Representative Johnson, do you want to make a final comment? Then we're going to lay the bill over. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I agree. Something needs to be done. We just got to find common ground, find out what's best for the state and for the citizens, and to protect the citizens as well.
I agree with that, and I hope law enforcement, Mr. Kingray, I hope law enforcement and prosecutors, because, prosecutors, frankly, county attorneys are politicians, and you got to deal with this too, and I think just saying no and taking the line that you have continually taken is not helpful to us sitting down and negotiating what I think is a responsible solution to this problem. I just want to say that on the record. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow.